This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowen. French philosopher Alex de Tocqueville said many things about America, including, quote, "In no other country in the civilized world is less attention paid to philosophy than in the United States." Our guest, Carlin Romano, could not disagree more. He argues in his new book, America the Philosophical, that the U.S. is the most philosophical culture in the history of the world. Really? He writes that the American brand of philosophy is more about real-world problems and the intellectual quest for truth. His book is about the wide range of American philosophers, from William James and Camille Paglia to B.F. Skinner and Hugh Hefner and his Playboy philosophy. Our guest, Carlin Romano, is critic-at-large at the Chronicle of Higher Education, also professor of philosophy and humanities at Ursinus College just outside of Philadelphia. And Carlin Romano, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
The most philosophical culture in the history of the world?
Yeah.
You stand by those words?
My bookstore dates, some people have called me on that and say, Mr. Romano, have you been around since the beginning of the world? And I say, well, no, but I read a lot of newspapers. I watch a lot of movies and so on. But actually, seriously, I often come back to people who have asked that and say, okay, what's your candidate? The most frequent answer is ancient Greece. And I say, oh, you know, ancient Athens, there's a really diverse society. Mm-hmm. You know, you got all your Athenian citizens and then the slaves and maybe about 17 different ethnicities and so on compared to the 100 or more, you know, here. You know, part of the argument of the book is that we have such an amazing range of belief systems in this country and so many opportunities for people to consider alternate belief systems, alternate arguments to change their lives. That, of course, it's a cliche that we're not a philosophical society. It's a cliche that ancient Athens was the glory of the world. But I think it's a false cliche.
Well, I want to pick up on all that, and I'm not here to argue any other culture because, frankly, I don't know enough to do that. But I wonder also the fact that in this country we have a First Amendment, that we have free speech, whether we exert it or not, whether that also has helped us to develop this culture that you're talking about.
Absolutely. That's one of the key arguments of the book also, that we have. And here, you know, I risk sounding jingoistic. I mean, you throw together a red, white, and blue cover, which every book with the word America in it seems to get, and some of these claims, and it can sound very jingoistic. I don't mean it to be jingoistic, but we do also have the broadest freedom of expression of any country I can think of historically. And that has a lot to do with what's possible here philosophically. You know, one thing that's come up in some of the bookstore dates has been the endless complaining about the descent of American deliberation and so on. A key example being that congressman who called out, "You lie," to Obama. Right. Now, I actually see that as a useful moment. I think a lot of American philosophy comes out of what I call our rude independence of mind, our willingness to resist authority. So I'm not claiming that that guy, when he said Wilson, when he said that, was actually engaged in philosophy. But those sort of things loosen up the culture. They make people understand that you can say almost anything, almost anywhere, in front of anyone. And that's very key to doing philosophy.
But isn't philosophy about the truth? I mean, don't you have to give some kind of approximation of the truth as opposed to lying about the truth?
Sure, yeah. No, I'm not opposed to truth. I'd be a little bit more finicky on the truth, you know, because I think truth varies and can vary by context and so on. But it's not at all my position, and some reviews have distorted this, that every delusional person on the street who can't pull together two sentences is a philosopher. I do think there are rough and ready rules that help you identify philosophy. You know, there has to be an openness to evidence. There has to be an understanding of how evidence relates to claims. There has to be some kind of sustained attention to a topic. There has to be a conceptual element to the subject you're talking about. But at the same time, I don't believe that there's a precise scientific definition of philosophy. And reasonable people could decide where to draw the lines.
Well, you also say that the American brand, if I can use that brand of philosophy, is pragmatic in nature. And I wonder whether that comes out of that frontier spirit, that whether we do it or not, we have this problem-solving ethos.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is hardly something original with me. In the early part of the book, I give a kind of cavalcade of classic American thought, what I call great white male thought, because I think too many people see philosophy as just what white males with beards and elbow patches, you know, have done. But I do that story. I do Emerson and Peirce and James and Dewey and so on. But people often misunderstand what they meant by pragmatism. They weren't saying anything goes. You just do whatever you want to make something work. What they were saying is that our very ideas and concepts come out of our problem solving, that we're all kind of agents in an environment where we have problems and we want to solve those problems, we want to reach goals. And the way we develop notions even like truth or action are based in those problematic situations. So pragmatism is not as simple-minded as many people think.
Well, reading your book took me back to my college days of many decades ago, taking philosophy classes, being mostly confused, mm-hmm. but being also intrigued by this notion about, and generally was about, you know, what is reality, seeing the flicker on the cave walls and what was real and what wasn't real. Mm-hmm. Is that still an important endeavor to wrestle with those ideas?
Yeah, it is particularly in professional philosophy, but I attack professional philosophy a lot in the book for giving disproportionate attention to what we call perception problems and mm-hmm. epistemology problems. Epistemology, just a $10 word for the theory of knowledge.
Yeah.
For a variety of historical reasons, the idea of epistemology has become the most prestigious notion in academic philosophy. So exactly what most Americans would mock, oh, we don't know that we know anything, is what people spend a lot of their time on in prestigious philosophy departments. When I argue for one of the heroes of my book, Richard Rorty, it's because I think he demolished that pretense. He showed that epistemology is a kind of empty enterprise and that Americans in particular ought to pay attention to much more challenging problems. I'll just give you one example. You know, there's a concept in so-called analytic epistemology called semantic blindness. And it's roughly the idea that we ordinary people don't know how to use the word no. Now, if you believe that, I think, okay, go in and take these courses and so on, but I think that's ludicrous, and yet it's actually a staple of a lot of epistemological work.
So you want to take philosophy out of the tower, the academy, put it down on the street where it belongs?
Not so much. I'm happy to leave philosophy in its precincts in the university. It's more an add-on. Right. I'm saying philosophy is not restricted to what goes on in philosophy departments. There is a lot of good philosophy that goes on in philosophy departments. I would draw the contrast, for instance, between philosophers of art and philosophers of knowledge. Philosophers of knowledge tend to use a pocket full of examples and say to me ludicrous things about knowledge. Philosophers of art, interestingly, are often almost defiantly proud of how much they know about art, pre-Columbian, Mongolian, the whole world, and they adjust their theories to all that data. So philosophy of art in the work of someone like Arthur Danto that I talk about in the book is actually much more modest than philosophy of knowledge, and yet much more convincing to my mind.
Well, let's roll back the clock to someone who I've never heard of, who you really say we owe a debt to, and is it Isocrates?
Isocrates.
So he predated Socrates and Plato and Aristotle.
Well, actually not. You know, it's funny, the New York Times reviewer blew it there. He got the birth dates reversed of Isocrates and Socrates. Socrates is actually an older figure than Isocrates. It's about 33 years older. But they're roughly contemporary. And, you know, I call my chapter Isocrates a Man, Not a Typo.
Exactly.
Jokingly, because most people haven't heard of Isocrates. Over the years, when I've told people about Isocrates, they say, oh, yeah, we did him in the first year of college. I said, no.
This is Isocrates.
Right.
But what is his contribution to philosophy?
Yeah, to me, he's very contemporary in that in addition to certain offshoots, such as his great concern with what it meant to be Greek, which is very much like our thoughts on what it means to be American. It's not an ethnicity. It's a set of beliefs. It's a way of conjoining yourself to traditions of a culture. That's very fresh. But chiefly, he was not someone who believed in searching after necessary and sufficient conditions for a lot of concepts. I was fortunate to have this Times review this Sunday on the front, you know, that gave a lot of space to the book, but I thought the reviewer misunderstood something crucial. You know, I was saying Isocrates has a different notion of philosophy, that deliberation is context-bound, conceptual definition may be context-bound. The reviewer then said, but you know, where does Isocrates do all of this investigation of love and truth and knowledge? Well, no, he doesn't, because he doesn't think that's a useful way to approach the topic. So in a way, Isocrates was somebody who believed that public deliberation in a given setting really brought us to our working definitions of concepts.
But do you see a lot of deliberation today?
I do. I think we have a lot in the U.S. I mean, in my introduction, I attack a lot of books that talk about the dumbing down of American culture.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah, titles like Idiot America. I'm sure they're, you know, assaulting your producers all the time. But the reality is, if you look at the warp and woof of the country, talk shows like yours, lots of magazines, serious newspapers, this is an enormous amount of serious deliberation, argument, presentation of evidence. One problem Americans often have is they don't compare the United States to other cultures on this planet. Mm-hmm. If you look at what's going on here and you compare it to Russia or China or even some of the West European countries, the degree of deliberation, the sweep of points of view, it's just amazing.
But why do you think we almost revel in talking about how stupid we are?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why is that such an attractive idea to Americans?
Yeah, I think it's partly that we have a tradition. You know, I mentioned some of those books. There was a great prize-winning book called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. It's a more complicated book than the title indicates. But we have always had this notion of mocking our intelligence, our intellectuality, maybe as a way of vaunting our can-do quality. But then, as many scholars have pointed out, you go back to the origins of the country, and this was a country created by intellectuals for intellectual reasons, who laid out their arguments, you know, in the Declaration, in the Federalist Papers. I mean, if you compare it to the origins of many other countries, we have a far more philosophical origin.
But we're almost up on a break here. But we also have a large percentage of the population do not believe in evolution. Millions of people believe that the world was created in several thousand years. Millions of people believe that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you reconcile the disconnect there?
Yeah, to me, it's not a disconnect, because my feeling is that people hold wrong opinions doesn't make the culture unphilosophical or even them unphilosophical. I mean, one way to respond is the old John Stuart Mill point. That
yeah, I thought you were going to say John Stewart, but no, go ahead.
No, no, John, you know, that if you have a culture in which your beliefs and your correct beliefs are nonetheless constantly challenged by incorrect beliefs,
right. You
will understand the intellectual terrain a lot better. You'll understand why you have the correct beliefs and so on. So, for instance, one way in which I would part company with my old pal, you know, Hitchens, is I don't think it's terrible to have a lot of believers around. I think because of the logical peculiarities of a lot of terms that relate to God and religion, you cannot disprove various religious claims. Mm-hmm. It's useful, actually, to understand the whole logic of the idea of divinity and so on, to have people around to be arguing about it. I shared Hitchens' view that I don't want the religious imposing, you know, moral values on the secular and so on. But when it comes to the actual metaphysics, the argument about belief, I think a culture in which believers and non-believers are grappling, going back at each other, arguing, is a philosophical culture.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Carlin Romano. And he's written a book called America the Philosophical. He's a professor of philosophy and humanities at Ursinus College, also critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're curious about what you think about what Carlin Romano is saying. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation, Library, Museum, and Center for Scholars supports WHYY. This first Friday, CHF celebrates the opening of the Alchemical Quest, a new exhibit using CHF's rare book collection to explore the early roots of chemistry. Live demonstrations will bring alchemical endeavors into the 21st century lab, and curator James Vogel will discuss his work with rare books. Presentations and tours are offered from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. chemheritage.org.
Next time in Studio 360, we roll out the red and white carpet. The 1st of July is Canada Day.
Yes, you didn't know we had a Canada Day?
I knew.
We have a capital, too, our nation's capital.
So, and I've been to Ottawa.
That's a good start.
Gian Gomeshi, the host of the CBC's Q, returns to test my knowledge of Canada. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Former State Department official Anne-Marie Slaughter revived the work family debate with her article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. Now our panel of moms joins the debate.
I've never looked to be ambitious as a man. I hope he want to be as ambitious as me, because men can't do what we do.
That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Colin Romano about his new book, America the Philosophical. In it, he argues that the United States has a unique brand of philosophy, one that's rooted in pragmatism. And that's what we're talking about, including many interesting chapters and diversions and anecdotes in this book as well. And taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, hearing what you say about ancient Greece, you also write that Howard Stern would not be unlike the celebrity rhetoricians of ancient Rome. Now, Howard Stern, you know, talking a lot about sex and bodily functions. Do you see parallels there?
Well, I do talk about talk show hosts. I mean, if I were doing a hierarchy, Howard would not be on top.
I figured.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned Charlie Rose, also Jon Stewart and others. But I do think there's a resemblance in the sense of these talk show hosts. And, you know, you do this also, Marty. You know, you provide a forum, you do good talk, you allow people to make arguments, you come back at them. This is not unlike what was being done in ancient Greece and what people were being trained in back then. Now, there is a greater entertainment function today. In my introduction, you know, I talk, for instance, about a Christian Science Monitor article that ran about Oprah Winfrey.
Yes.
And the title was, you know, Oprah Winfrey, yes, the greatest existential philosopher ever. And I ask, is that a smirky title? Well, it wasn't a smirky title, actually. It was an honest and a respectful title, because she actually has engaged people in some very deep and thoughtful conversations over the years. So, you know, in this book, I'm really trying to kind of tear down a lot of cliches and robotic responses to the word philosophy and what it means to philosophize. I think Oprah Winfrey has done good work.
Well, let me pick up on someone else you write about, Robert Fulghum. He wrote that famous book, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, which has all sorts of, I would say, digestible aphorisms, you know, don't hit people, play fair, essentially golden rules, ways of living in the world. But I don't think of that as philosophy. I mean, to me, that's kind of pop psychology.
Right. And I throw that in a section that I call the casual wise men. And, you know, and I mentioned the book is meant to be representative and not comprehensive. I say that several times. So, you know, I had one reviewer who said, oh, your book is terrible because you don't have A and B and C. And my response was, everybody you mention is a further confirmation of my thesis. I mean, you know, it's meant to be representative. But with these folks, Fulghum, for instance, is somebody who actually is a very serious reader. You know, in my years at the Philadelphia Inquirer and at the Chronicle, I've gotten to meet a lot of these people and get a beat on them personally. So he's a great fan of Wittgenstein, a great fan of Nietzsche, people who wrote in an aphoristic tradition. Now, it's fair to say his aphorisms may be very simplistic or simple-minded, or maybe they're just simple, right? I mean, is Jesus simplistic or is he simple? One thing I try to represent in the book, and I do this probably most strongly with Susan Sontag, who would be treated more respectfully by most people than Robert Fulghum, is to say that the aphoristic tradition is also a philosophical tradition in Chinese thought, Indian thought, and in Western European thought. So Fulghum may be pushing the envelope a little bit, but that's one reason he's there, to show that it is possible to think that way too.
It is a Hallmark card philosophy, though?
Well, you know, if you go through a CVS and read those Hallmark cards, I think you'll see a lot of really saccharine nonsense. And every once in a while, right, you're looking for that card you want to buy for your family member. You may see a thought that actually surprises you by its pithiness, by its rightness, and that's the one you buy. So no, on the whole, I wouldn't vaunt that as the leading edge of American philosophy, but I guess I believe in a sort of respectful, modest taking in of information and saying, might this be philosophically significant?
Well, what I hear in your argument is that and I'm speaking generally, we tend to divide culture into kind of high culture, low culture. Right. And it sounds like you want to figure out how to connect the two or take away those barriers or even maybe those descriptions about culture.
Yeah, actually, I have a very specific part of the book that addresses that. Early in the book, in my introduction, I say, after establishing the contrary thesis and saying, isn't it really America, the unphilosophical? I spend almost 30 pages putting out a lot of detail on that. Then the rest of the book is an attempt to make my argument. Early on, what I do is I make this short argument, and with a lot of detail, I think, that in the arts, we have seen a collapse of the highbrow, middlebrow, lowbrow mentality. Some of that came out of the work of Susan Sontag, a critic named Gilbert Seldes, and so on. We haven't seen that collapse in regard to philosophy. We still have this notion that what they're doing in the philosophy departments, that's highbrow and that's philosophy and everything else isn't. So I very directly address that and say this isn't true to the nature of the concept over time, historically. It's not true to what we do in society today. And we ought to abandon this kind of hierarchy.
Well, and it seems to me that on television, a perfect blending of that is the Colbert Report, which is a mix of highbrow. The smarter you are, the more informed you are, the better the show is, but it also operates on another level as well.
Sure. And you could say, with Colbert, of course, there's an ironic cast to the entire enterprise. Well, there's an ironic cast to Socrates. There's an ironic cast to many writers over time, that we have seen as philosophers. Nietzsche is very sarcastic and ironic. So I don't think the irony and entertainment aspect of somebody's thought, even a talk show host's thought or a comic's thought, invalidates what they're doing as philosophy.
Let me pick up on, I do want to get to our callers, but you mentioned Richard Rorty as someone that we should know, a very influential when it comes to American philosophy. I think you call him the Rhett Butler of American philosophy.
Right, yeah, because
he's pretty nice.
Thank you. I mean, the book is supposed to be lively.
No, I understand.
Try and have jazzy language throughout so it's not just for academics, but, that's an image everybody knows, and he kind of walked away from what his life was. He was a typical analytic philosopher who was nonetheless a great reader, a teacher of mine at Princeton. And he helped all of us sort of see through a lot of the artificiality of analytic philosophy. So the Rhett Butler image is really meant to establish him as a maverick. He was the great maverick of late 20th century American philosophy.
Is there a way to distill what his philosophy was?
Yeah, well, one way would be that we should abandon the idea that you have these gigantic blimp terms like meaning, truth, and knowledge that have very scientific criteria. And if we just keep working in our philosophy departments a couple of more years, we're going to solve it. We're not going to solve it because it's a misunderstanding of how these words operate in language. So, roughly speaking, he believed in a much more sort of contextual, conversational attempt to understand cultural politics, cultural terms, and he believed we had to sort of like fight in our cultures for our understanding of concepts. Just one quick example, that relates to the kinds of things you're always talking to guests about, the concept of a right. What is a right? Is a right something that's hanging in the air the way, Plato thought a lot of concepts were? No. Rights are things that people create by protesting and fighting for beliefs and so on. Then we look back and say, you have a right to be married. You have a right to vote. Well, no, it wasn't hanging there in the sky. You achieved that. So our understanding of a right, I think, is very much like our understanding of many other concepts.
Let me reintroduce you. I do want to get some callers in on the conversation, talking with Carlin Romano. He's got a new book called America, the Philosophical. He's a professor of philosophy and humanities at Ursinus College, which is located just outside of Philadelphia. He's also a critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education. And we do have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY, talking about philosophy, American style, today on the show. Let's see what Paul from East Falls has to say. And Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Professor Mano, thank you for all your articles. I've enjoyed reading you over the years. My question is, it's American culture, the past 20th century, Eastern influences, Buddhism, yoga, those type of things have had a lot of influence on popular culture. I'm just wondering if you might comment on what, if any, influence it has had on American philosophy.
Fair enough. Paul, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's part of the landscape that I think is very important. You know, in the book, again, it's 672 pages. If it were 1,000 pages, I might have been able to include Alan Watts, who I thought of writing a section on. I might have been able to write about Latino philosophers and Hmong philosophers. Absolutely, the Asian influence on American thought is key. I just came back from California. Wandering through the bookstores there, I noticed how much larger the Asian philosophy sections are in California, which is a good thing. So I think, yeah, we've had a lot of attention, you know, to Buddhism, to Taoism, and that's a part of the landscape here. Let me juxtapose your question with the question that came up before. Let's go back to ancient Athens. Were they paying much attention to Buddhism? Would they have been a stronger philosophical culture if they were also thinking about Buddhism and Confucianism and Taoism? Again, it's a kind of funny hypothetical, I suppose, but that's one of the reasons I think we do have a stronger culture.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You do, though, include 8 pages on Hugh Hefner and his Playboy philosophy.
I do.
You do. Why did you do
and
that?
And I worked very hard to find that photo. You like that photo?
That's the old or the new old.
Well,
you have
after you know, dredging through thousands of photos of him surrounded by 50 women in very little clothing, I found this photo of him in which he looks like Bertrand Russell, you know, with the pipe and the hat. So that was
Is that how we should think of him, though?
Well, that was a real gotcha day. Seriously, I do think he belongs in that section of the casual wise men because let me say this brief for Hefner. I think he did have a significant effect on notions of sexuality in this country. He did write a gang of articles that were later gathered as the Playboy philosophy. You know, I've had a number of feminist controversies in my career. There are feminists for free expression. There are feminists who are not so strong for free expression. People disagree on Hefner's role, usually because they disagree on what's an appropriate sexuality for women. But I would say that in his civil libertarian mode and in the kinds of pieces that he did for Playboy, and my understanding is he did them. I did spend time with him. He's a very smart guy. He's quick on the take. He had a stroke. He came back from it. He's good with counterexamples. He obviously likes to sleep with young blonde women. That's one part of his life. But I think if you look to a philosopher as someone who has reasonably coherent beliefs mm-hmm. that are influential, that makes arguments for them, that actually pushes the ideas out in the culture, and maybe one result is you have all these Italian guys with, you know, with rabbits on their rearview mirrors. That's one result. But you have other results, which is that people think about sexuality in an enormously different way. I discovered in doing my research on Hefner for the book that the Bertrand Russell Society, which is a society wholly made up of philosophers, has actually been considering him for its Bertrand Russell Award because of his civil libertarian work. Now, I just have to add one last thing. If you know the biography of Bertrand Russell, you know that Bertrand Russell and Hugh Hefner were not very different when it came to women.
No, I hear you, and I don't have a problem with that. I think the question that gets raised is, did he come up with this philosophy because he was a philosopher or because he was a businessman, made a lot of money promoting this philosophy? And maybe you can be both, but to me that's part of the struggle.
Yeah, that's a fair question. Again, you can ask whether the admixture of any other motives invalidates what a philosopher is arguing. You know, if Hume or Hobbes any of the great philosophers had some separate political motivations or even religious motivations for what they argued, does that take away from what they argued? So I think you have the same situation with Hefner. I would say for anybody who's interested in this, the last few years there have been at least two very serious academic biographies of Hefner that go into his career, and I think they actually support my side he should be seen as a serious cultural influence.
So you can be popular and rich and a philosopher.
I think so, yeah. Okay. Isocrates was actually one of the richest in Athens.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I learned so much about Isocrates reading your book and today on the show. Let me get Chad from Phoenixville to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chad. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I was interested into what degree the conclusion that America is the most philosophical culture we arrive at by simply redefining philosophy, and to what extent the point is more substantive. I raise the question because in Professor Romano's chapter on Isocrates, he quotes David Temerman as claiming, quote, Plato was the winner of this definitional battle over philosophy, Socrates the loser. And I would think, according to de Tocqueville, America pays less attention to philosophy than a lot of cultures in the Platonic sense. But if we change the meaning of the word philosophy, then there are a lot of ways that pragmatistic traditions and people like Isocrates can be philosophical, but their preoccupations are mundane enough that they are devoid of the sense of wonder that I think Plato and Aristotle, for all their differences, agreed was essential to philosophy. Mm. I'm interested in the professor's reaction to that.
Me too, Chad, and I appreciate the call. Go ahead.
And boy, am I delighted that you have the book on your lap and you're quoting Timmerman, who's one of the good scholars on that. Well, you know, the Times Review yesterday said that my redefinition or recasting of philosophy was nebulous. I don't think it's nebulous. I think it's fairly clear. I also think I'm raising a more profound question, whether I am in a effect redefining it, or whether it was defined in a particular way back in Athens in favor of Isocrates, but then Plato ran away with the show. In other words, the point I'm making in that chapter is that the word philosophy wasn't tied down yet, and that Plato, particularly in the way that he described Socrates, in the way that he alluded mainly to Isocrates, managed to distance Isocrates from what was then seen as a type of philosophy. Isocrates very much thought he was doing philosophy. He used that word all the time. So I think that while it could be said I'm redefining it, I would prefer to say I'm asking us to go back and look at the situation in ancient Athens and to think about the way these different figures argued, to think about the way we argue and ask what is a more appropriate definition of philosophy.
Let me though pick up on the way Chad phrased it, because I thought it was interesting, which is that that the philosophy that you're talking about and maybe even promoting is more about the mundane, and his concern is that without thinking about what is truth, that you lose the wonder of the universe.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think Isocrates did think about the big concepts also, and I'm not claiming that philosophy is a concentration on the mundane. I mean, if, you know, on the Inquirer editorial page, there's a debate about whether you should have coin parking meters or, you know, magnetic card parking meters. I don't think that's a philosophical debate, although it could become one if people started to introduce concepts like convenience, for instance. Convenience can be an interesting concept. So, again, I don't think there's a precise philosophical line. You know, going back to Aristotle and the Nicomachean Ethics, we have the idea that things should not be made more precise conceptually than they can bear. He was trying to make a point between ethics and mathematics. Mathematics was precise, ethics not so precise. You come forward to the 20th century, you have a great philosopher such as Wittgenstein, who, in a wonderful line, said that a blurred concept is still a concept. So I'm not arguing that philosophy is the investigation of the mundane. I still think it's conceptual analysis, but I don't think there are rigid boundaries there.
Well, we're almost having a break here. I guess sometimes when it's described as pragmatic, then it's thought of as problem solving, as dealing with the parking meters, as opposed to the ideas behind a parking meter.
Yeah, and even as far back as the time of William James, that sort of degradation of the word, or you might say alteration of the word, was taking place. So I think that this is just a matter of cultural literacy to understand that pragmatism as a philosophical viewpoint is not the same as simple problem solving.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers. Just a couple open lines. Chad, thanks for the call. You can call as well. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Carlin Romano today on Radio Times about his new book called America, the Philosophical. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is Jeff Bundy, WHYY's Director of Member Relations. On August 3rd, WHYY-TV and PBS stations across the country will be premiering a new documentary produced locally by WHYY. The Barnes Collection tells the story of Dr. Albert C. Barnes and his impressive art collection. Support WHYY's local productions with a $120 donation and we'll thank you by sending you two tickets to visit the Barnes Foundation's new home on the Ben Franklin Parkway. Call 1-888-345-9499 or visit WHYY.org.
On the next Fresh Air, if you're barbecuing fish and it slips through the grill, what do you do?
Do you have a cat? Because that cat's going to eat well. You're pretty much done. At that point, you've sacrificed the fish to the charcoal gods.
Advice from Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Carlin Romano about philosophy and philosophers, which you can find almost anywhere in America, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to get back to our callers, but let me just ask you about the president. You call Obama the country's, quote, philosopher-in-chief. Any more philosophical than any president we've had before?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've had a tradition of philosopher presidents, you know, going back to Jefferson, Madison, Lincoln. I think I say he's the most philosophical since Wilson. And I don't mean it lightly. I'm not saying he's Immanuel Kant. But the argument I make in my epilogue is that in a variety of ways, his deliberative style, his intellectuality, his vast reading in philosophical sources, he is more philosophical than some of our recent chief executives. I really approach it in two ways. In one, I ride on a book, a very good book I hope your listeners will look at, called Reading Obama by James Kloppenberg, who's a great intellectual historian at Harvard. Kloppenberg went back, he looked at Obama's work at Occidental, at Columbia, at Harvard when he's working with Larry Tribe, his reading of Niebuhr. Obama is a very well-read guy who has taken philosophy seriously. Even in the jokey, matters that have gone on about his letters to his girlfriend in Marinus's new book, he's kind of philosophical. So I don't think that undermines it. So that's part of the story with Obama. What I also do is I look at some of his speeches, in particular the Nobel Prize speech, which I don't think got sufficient attention. Now, I'm somebody who has loved lines such as a wonderful line by the great peace activist A.J. Mustay, who once said, "There is no way to peace. Peace is the way." That's a beautiful line.
Right.
I would say Obama's Nobel Prize speech is almost a response to that line. He shows up, as you remember, in Scandinavia, everybody saying he shouldn't have won this, it's too soon, he's running two wars. That speech is a truly pithy, philosophical attempt to say why force sometimes has to be used for the purpose of good. You could disagree with the specific case. Maybe that's not the case in Iraq or Afghanistan. But it was a genuinely philosophical speech, as was his famous speech in Cairo, which I thought put forth the notion of cosmopolitanism, that the President of the United States has to think of Americans as world citizens as well as citizens. We have to care about other people in the world. So I think there's a lot of evidence there for Obama as a philosopher-in-chief. I've gotten to like him more, frankly, in his time as president. And I kind of end the book by saying, if he is a philosopher-in-chief, we deserve one.
Mm.
We're that kind of culture.
Because we're America, the philosophical.
That's right.
Fair enough. Let me get Neil from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. And Neil, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm enjoying the program, but, it seems to me that Americans are much more interested in announcing their philosophy than they are in actually ever discussing it. I mean, Aristotle's phrase about the unexamined life is worth living. When you mention creationists, they just want to announce to the world that Darwin's wrong, Einstein's wrong, and their curious reading of the Bible that makes the Earth 6,000-year-old is right. And I feel like a lot of what Dr. Romano is saying is philosophy is more like standing on a platform and yelling out, "This is the right philosophy, and the rest of you should all shut up."
Well, Neil,
do you feel that way?
No, let's find out. Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, no, I sympathize with what you're saying, and I don't think mere assertion is philosophy. But I would ask you to take a step back. Ask yourself, how did those people get to the point at which they're putting forth those assertions? You know, I had an interesting question at one of my bookstore talks. Somebody said to me, okay, Mr. Romano, do you actually think people change their minds more in America than any place else? Is that part of your thesis? And, you know, being part journalist, I did the usual thing. I thought for 10 seconds, and then I answered. But my answer was this. Okay, I grant, if you're talking about people who are over 45, probably they don't change their minds a lot, and they're turning often more into asserters than arguers. But then I thought, what about kids, let's say, from 8 to 25 in this country, and the degree to which they change their minds, they're exposed to different beliefs, they look at evidence, and the Mormon becomes a Lubavitcher, and the Lubavitcher becomes secular, and so on and so forth. I found myself circling back to my thesis. I do think that even when you look at these fundamentalists, if you think they're way wrong, the Tea Party types, you're not born a Tea Party type. You're not a Tea Partier in the crib. You come to that. Now, maybe you think someone comes to that for bad reasons. Well, then argue against that. But I think you're seeing a lot of movement among people in the United States, even when they come to ultimately ideological and assertive positions. Once they reach that stage and they're no longer open to argument, I don't consider them philosophers.
What do you consider them?
Ideologues, I suppose. Yeah. But one of the nice things about our culture as a philosophical culture is that you can't sort of be at peace as an ideologue in this culture because there's always someone coming at you from the other side. The left has to deal with the right has to deal with the left, the believers have to deal with the non-believers. That's the churning that I actually see taking place in our country.
You mentioned eight-year-olds, and I do think, based on your definition of philosophy, that eight-year-olds really are philosophers because they are figuring out the world, asking
Absolutely.
All those important questions about how the world works.
Yeah, and a lot of ways, I mean, people have said to me, oh, but come on, wasn't Tocqueville right? We don't pay much attention to philosophy. Well, that's true if you restrict philosophy to everything that has the Good Housekeeping seal traditionally as philosophy. I think it's a little bit more like, you know, Molière's bourgeois gentleman who doesn't know he's speaking prose. We don't recognize that we're philosophizing. Mm-hmm. Kids do philosophize, and the movement of teaching philosophy to children is actually a growing one.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me get Stacy from Bryn Mawr to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Stacy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So my question is, given the political rancor right now in Congress, and you mentioned before about a lack of cultural literacy, and I all the time marvel at a lack of historical literacy and political philosophy, and folks are talking about liberalism and philosophy of markets and freedom and in my opinion, how neoliberals reintroduced the concept of liberty and freedom and then sort of co-opted in a hegemonic way a large part of our population to act against their interests. But mostly that folks, I feel like, don't have knowledge of history or political philosophy, and yet they're legislating and you know, could be called contemporary philosophers, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
Okay, and I think I understand what you're saying there. I mean, it sounds like Carlin, she's saying that if you don't know something, can you in a sense legislate? Can you run the government?
Right. Well, you know, in a democracy, we don't always get the most intellectually fluent people, you know, in the legislature. I do think it would be a good idea if everybody in politics took a little break, maybe in August, and read the Federalist Papers and read some of the foundational documents of the country, because it's certainly true that we hear a lot of people talking incorrectly about what the founders and framers wanted for the country, what they said, what the challenges were, and so on. In my Chronicle Critic at Large role, I did a review recently of a book by a radio talk show host, Mike Levin, called Ameritopia, that just seemed to me absolutely wrong-headed about the notion of utopia, you know, the idea that we're now in a fascist state run by the dictator Obama. I mean, there's just a lot of nonsense out there. So, yeah, cultural literacy in the philosophical beginnings of our country would be a very good thing.
But what do you do about something called confirmation bias, which is that people seek out the information that reinforces what they believe anyway. What do you do about that as a philosopher?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the great antidotes to that is having the fantastic free expression culture that we have. Because in our culture, at least, people often are caught facing the opposition. It may be while they're sitting in an airline terminal and they're watching Fox when they don't usually watch Fox, or they're watching CNN when they don't usually watch CNN. Or because we're the kind of culture where people sit next to each other on an airplane, total strangers, and start telling each other their whole lives, there's suddenly a right-wing person sitting next to a left-wing person, and they're trying to play it out. I had a wonderful conversation with an Iranian-American woman at this conference in Stanford who was against the U.S. on almost every possible way. It was a wonderful conversation because we were able to go at each other and put forth things. So I think there's nothing any individual can do so much except maybe attempt to enlighten the benighted. But our free expression culture does a lot of the work.
Let me get Gary from Dover to join our conversation. Gary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I think that the professor was kind of slightly touching on this, but it is my opinion that what shapes philosophy is oftentimes history, and that America, or at least Americans in the whole, since it's so pro-American, that is what shapes their pro-philosophical ideas on how great we are, so to speak. Being an African-American male, you know, and loving history, I've often had to read about this stuff, and not kind of funny that, okay, well, if it's so great, the Constitution, First Amendment, blah, 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 blah. Okay, well, the Constitution came from gentlemen who were slave owners and slave owners before their presidency and after their presidency. You speak of the Greeks, and oftentimes we talk about their philosophical stuff and how it just shaped Western culture. Well, where did they exactly get their ideas from? You know, we don't speak of that they traveled throughout Africa and learned from the universities of Timbuktu and Kush, and, you know, in places like Africa or in Egypt and things like that. So if the professor can kind of elaborate on, you know, that history also plays a lot into learning or shaping one's philosophy.
Gary, I appreciate the cult radio.
Sure, I agree, and I'd speak to two things there. One, I completely agree with you about America not being a perfect culture historically, and particularly in regard to African Americans and African American philosophy. I have a long stretch in the book about African American philosophy, going back to, you know, Martin Delaney, David Walker, you know, up to people like, you know, Cornel West. I in no way argue in this book, and that's one reason it's not jingoistic, that America has always been the best place in all ways for all people. I don't agree with you on the issue of the Greeks and some of the theses which I heard there of Afrocentrism, and I'd invite you to take a look at my section in the book about the debate between Mary Lefkowitz and Asante and the Afrocentrists, because I think that's an interesting debate in regard to African-American philosophy.
Which is probably better for a whole other show. Gary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Peter has to say. Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm from Cranberry, New Jersey, also an Ursinus grad, class of 62.
There you go.
Right.
My question for the professor is, it seems to me that philosophy and philosophical thinking requires some discipline of mind and some thoughtfulness, and I'm wondering whether or not the electronic gadgets that people have, and particularly children have, and their focus on these video games and things might be taking us in the wrong direction in terms of thinking philosophically.
Well, Peter, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Go ahead, Carlin.
Yeah, I think the verdict is still out there. I teach a course at Ursinus, actually, called Cyber Philosophy, and I had a bunch of cyber whizzes in my class last term. You know, from one side, you can say that there's an enormous amount of distraction. You can also say that tweeting is too pithy. It doesn't permit argument. It allows people not to connect their thoughts or to suddenly express themselves without any meditation and so on. On the other hand, there's an enormous amount of back and forth, of response to criticism and to counter evidence and so on. So I think it's hard to say where all this is going to lead, but there's an enormous amount of verbal activity going on. I think that's one good sign. Whether this is going to lead to some of these people who are playing video games at 13, writing philosophical books at 30, I don't know.
Did you read comic books as a kid, though?
I did, and they were helpful.
Exactly. Well, yes. that inside was almost the point of my question. Let me ask you about Camille Paglia, who is a Philadelphia-based professor, and you call her the steel-plated Madonna of American intellectual life, and I think she probably would like that description.
Yeah, she likes that kind of stuff. I think Camille is a fascinating figure. I was one of the first people to write about her, you know, here in Philadelphia. As you know from that section in the book, she was very competitive with Susan Sontag. And, you know, I'll be remembered when Susan Sontag is gone and so on. I think Camille went through a period where she was on every show you could name and was really out there and maybe paid a little bit of a price for that in her reputation, which was established with Sexual Personae, yes. A very good and powerful book. Seems to me she's not out there in the media as much as she used to, and that may mean that she's really bringing this long-promised second volume to fruit. I hope so.
Let me quote William James. I believe I'm quoting correctly. We have about a minute before we have to say goodbye. To be a real philosopher, you need to hate someone else's thinking. True? Not true?
Well, you know, it gets the blood going. I use that quote at the beginning of the section there, and it's probably not the most representative quote of James, who was a famously genial, kind, and friendly person.
But I think what he's saying is you need an argument, right? I mean, in the best sense of the word.
And you've got to care. You've got to care.
And do you like, I mean, it sounds like, is this what you do? You argue and discuss and debate and care?
I'm easy to get along with, Marty. No, but I do care about issues, and
I'm not laughing at you.
I think of philosophy as a discipline that doesn't take yes for an answer.
Right. Oh, interesting. Yeah. So my
mind kind of works in that way.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us. And Carlin Romano has been our guest today on Radio Times. His new book, it's about 600 and something or other pages. It's called America, the Philosophical. He's a professor of philosophy and humanities at Ursinus College, also critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We appreciate all those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including many of our social media, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.